Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy, New York, and WOOS 98.9 FM, Schenectady, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media. I'm your host, H. Bosch Jr.
And I'm Jada. Today, Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Mark Dunley speak with Reverend Richard Witt of Rural Migrant Ministry.
Then we'll have a live interview with Peter Lesser, the executive director of The Egg in Albany.
And later on, Roman Labor correspondent Willie Terry reports on the New York State Black and Puerto Rican Legislators Weekend Caucus.
After the interview, high school student Amari Allen, all right, our newest and greatest intern, and her experiences with technology.
And we wrap it up with Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Larry Becker and Tyshawn Golston of Hitters Boxing Club. But first, headlines.
Okay. New York Attorney General Letitia James, Democrat, subpoenaed Deutsche Bank in relationship to three major loans associated with President Trump's business dealings. The documents are connected to nearly $400 million in loans used to Doral Golf Resort in Miami, the Trump International Hotel in Washington, D.C., and the Trump International Hotel and Tower in Chicago. The Attorney General has also subpoenaed records on another loan Trump sought to buy the NFL Buffalo Bills. Michael Cohen testified before Congress last month that Trump inflated his net worth when he submitted documents to the Deutsche Bank in order to secure loans. The House Financial Services and Intelligence Committees have also requested records from the bank.
Albany youth and supporters will gather in West Capitol Park at 11 a.m. on Friday, March 15th, to protest government inaction on climate change. The event is taking place because, quote, world leaders have yet to acknowledge, prioritize, and properly address our climate crisis. Isra Hirsi, the 16-year-old daughter of Congressperson Ilhan Omar, is one of three youth leaders planning the U.S. component of Friday's International Youth Climate Strike. The event is planned, organized, led, and championed by youth. The coordinated global school walkout and strike was inspired by Swedish activist Greta Thunberg, who started the first student climate strike outside the Swedish Parliament building. The 16-year-old Thunberg has been nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize 1,700 towns and cities in over 100 different countries have plans to participate in the youth strike for climate taking place on Friday.
A resolution presented by the current Rensselaer Mayor Rich Mone from August 2007. Mone's resolution would authorize the annexation of the Dunn property into the city of Rensselaer. Notice, for both the amendment and the main issue, Mone voted in favor of both times, while several other council members were opposed. The council knew that Dunn wanted the lands annexed to the city of Rensselaer because the towns of North Greenbush and East Greenbush did not want to be involved in the landfill. Mr. Mone has failed to address concerns from residents on the dump and points sole blame on DEC. Now residents are dealing with the consequences. This was why the city standing on landfills in 2003 when Mark Pratt was mayor. Whereas the proposed landfill would have serious negative impacts on the city, its roads, and its community and neighborhood character due to the noise, odor, dust, and offense visual impacts associated with the landfill. And with large number of heavy trucks carrying construction and demolition debris traveling over city streets and through city neighborhoods, and would also be contrary to the city's effort to restore and enhance its downtown area waterfront and residential neighborhoods. And because of these undesirable impacts, every city administration from 1996 to the present has taken vigorous action and successfully opposed the opening of the proposed landfill at considerable cost to the city and taxpayers.
According to the Times Union, recently released data from the Center for Economic Growth show the Capital Region is home to 21 video game development studios that employ 418 people. The region's gaming cluster includes prominent studios like Vicarious Visions and PUBG Mad Glory, which have helped develop popular games like Guitar Hero 3, Legends of Rock, and more recently, Players Unknown Battlegrounds.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
To learn more about this program and how to support sanctuaries for independent medias, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. After decades of effort, the Farm Worker Fair Labor Practices Act may finally pass the New York State Legislature this year. Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Mark Dunley speaks with Reverend Richard Witt of Rural Migrant Ministry.
This is Mark Dunley, and we're talking with Reverend Richard Witt of the Rural Migrant Ministries. Seems like the entire time I've known Richard, which seems like at least 20 years or so, he has been working to try to help get New York State to adopt legislation to provide basic labor and human rights to farm workers. Every year we think this is it. Hopefully this is the year, but Reverend, why don't you just give us a brief overview about both what the Rural Migrant Ministry is and why this is an important issue?
Sure. Rural Migrant Ministry is a statewide nonprofit organization that's affiliated with 13 faith bodies representing over a million people across the state of New York. And since the 1990s, we have been standing with the farm workers of New York State at their request to work to change New York's labor laws to include farm workers, because going all the way back to the 1930s, New York's farm workers have been excluded or exempted from many of the basic rights afforded most other New Yorkers.
Yeah, and I believe also this is somewhat true of some of the federal legislation, you know, the New Deal and the minimum wage, that, you know, professions or jobs where a lot of people of color were involved, like I think initially, you know, maids and house servants and farm workers, were not provided the same type of protection that the, you know, the white workers were provided.
That's correct. And in fact, back in the time of the New Deal, when President Roosevelt was trying to institute protections, improve working conditions, he wanted to pass a number of laws, and Southern Dixiecrats said to him, "You need our votes, but we're not going to give you our votes if you include farm workers and domestic workers, because we will not have black workers treated the same as white workers." And you can actually find record of that in the congressional record.
So what are some of the things that this particular bill would do to help farm workers?
This is a very simple bill in its approach. It basically would go through New York labor laws, and where there are rights afforded laborers, and in law it says except farm workers, it would remove the except farm workers. So, for example, all workers are entitled to a day of rest except farm workers. It would remove that except farm workers.
And so what are some of the prospects in this, you know, session? Obviously, one of the barriers has been that for many years the Republicans controlled the Senate. That's obviously not the case this year with the Democrats. But the Farm Bureau has always been a powerful opponent, and they're still around. So are you a little bit more optimistic this year?
We are always hopeful. You know, our overall goal is to improve the agricultural system within New York to ensure the well-being of farm workers and farmers. It's difficult to work toward that strengthening of the system when you have a group of people that are marginalized and treated as second class. So the Democrats in the New York State Senate have long said that they believed in the equality of all workers, and that if they gained control of the Senate, that they would pass the Farm Worker Fair Labor Practices Act. So we are hopeful that they will remain true to their word, and that we can all get on to strengthening New York's agriculture for all of us.
Now, how has some of the, you know, labor unions been on this? I know from my own experience working as an anti-poverty organizer that a lot of times the lowest income workers were not always really championed as strongly as one might hope from the labor movement, probably because they weren't represented by organized labor. But certainly over the years, there's been more efforts to organize, you know, farm workers into unions. How has that played out with labor and their support?
The New York State AFL has been front and center in calling for the passage of this legislation through their president, Mario Cilento. They have made it clear repeatedly that this is important to them, and Mario specifically has made the point that these are fellow brothers and sisters, human beings, and that the AFL is committed to their well-being, whether they are members of the AFL or not.
Now, you mentioned the issue that you are working to try to improve the, you know, economic situation of not just farm workers, but farmers, but, you know, certainly the farmers that, you know, that I encounter that end up opposing the bill, that's usually, yeah, we understand they need a higher wage, but, you know, we're the ones that really get the lowest wages, and unfortunately, in our economic system, we're not really reimbursed enough to grow food, and therefore it's hard for us to pay, you know, our workers a living wage when in reality we don't make a living wage. You know, is that one of the issues that get raised at the state capitol?
You know, if you divide the whole agricultural system up and see it as a pie, the farm workers get the small slice and the farmers don't get that much a bigger slice. So it really is an issue that has to do with our whole food system. That being said, we can't justify an unjust system on the backs of a particular group of people. And at this point, those backs are historical backs of people of color. And that needs to change. The farm workers need to have a chance to live more fully. And while the farmers are getting a small piece of the pie and face many issues, the attempts by the Farm Bureau to make this an issue, pitting farmers against farm workers, especially small family farmers against farm workers, is the wrong direction. Let's agree that everybody needs to be treated equally and with dignity, and find other ways to improve this system rather than saying we can't afford to have a just system and we therefore can't afford to treat these men, women, and children who are farm workers with dignity and respect.
So we have about 2 minutes left. So how does this progress through the rest of the state legislature? Is it done part of the budget or outside of the budget? And if, you know, if people want to, you know, talk to their legislators about this issue, how best can they convey their concerns?
Well, we need to make sure that the members of the New York State Assembly and the New York State Senate hear from constituents urging them to pass the Assembly bill, which is Bill number 2750, and the Senate bill, which is Bill number 2837, same bill, known as the Farm Worker Fair Labor Practices Act. Folks need to reach out to their legislators and tell them that they want a state that honors the dignity of all.
So if people want more information, I'm sure Rural Migrant Ministries has a website, or there's a particular website for the bill as well?
Sure. It's ruralmigrantministry.org, and that will lead you to this effort, or you can go to the campaign website itself, which is Farmworker New York. That's FARMWORKERSNY.org. FarmworkersNewYork.org.
Well, thank you very much, Reverend Witt, for joining us today. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk.
And I'm your host, H. Bosch Jr. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have questions, suggestions, or sour bone to pick, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in at 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary and a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region. Okay. Hudson Mohawk Magazine Network Roman Labor correspondent Willie Terry attended workshops on Saturday, February 16th at the New York State Black and Puerto Rican Legislators Weekend Caucus, entitled Black Studies and Black Students Matter and Dismantling Systemic Racism in Education at the Empire Plaza. In this segment, you will hear excerpts, speeches, and workshops from New York State Senator Kevin Parker and State Organizing Director for Citizen Action, Jamaica Miles.
How's everybody doing?
All right.
Good. So I'm glad you guys came by here. I'm actually here by accident, but y'all are in my wheelhouse. Y'all know who I am. I'm State Senator Kevin Parker. I represent the 21st District of Brooklyn, which is Flatbush and East Flatbush, Midwood, Dippins Park, Windsor Terrace, and Park Slope. I'm the chair of the Energy and Telecommunications Committee in the New York State Senate, as well as the Majority Whip. And in my other life, I'm actually an Africana Studies professor, right? So I went to undergrad Penn State University. I actually have a minor in Africana Studies there. The thing that brought me to Africana Studies was really being a kid from Brooklyn, right? Went to public school my whole life, graduated from Midwood High School in Brooklyn, go to Penn State, think I was gonna be a football player, wind up on this huge campus of 70,000 undergraduate students with less than 3,000 black students, and a hostile white community that I'm living in, right? Both professors and students. I was in school, none of y'all were probably born yet. I was there from 85 to 89. It was in the middle of the fight for the end of apartheid in South Africa. And so there was a whole movement around black studies and black students that was actually predicated and came out of the struggles that were really happening. And so you had many of us who got engaged with the struggle to fight against apartheid and getting our universities to divest their money out of companies that were doing business in South Africa, right? And then that led, once that actually that happened in 1988, then led us to start looking at our own conditions and start, because we had been studying South Africa and apartheid, started seeing how those same dynamics were happening on our campus. And then that harkened us back to 1969 and kind of what happened in San Francisco and San Francisco State, where Nathan Hare actually created the first program and the first program. There's a difference, if you know academia, between a program and a department, right? A program can offer courses, but only a department can confer degrees, right? And so it really wasn't even until almost the beginning of the 80s that you actually started having departments that actually could confer degrees, right? And most and we've had it over the last 10 years, actually last 20 years really, a regression back to programs from departments. So we went from a period where we were conferring degrees in black studies and then going back to departments where they're courses but not necessarily degrees. In part because people weren't really finding a lot of practical application to keep it funky. But there has been that same period of growth in graduate programs. The first PhD in Africana Studies actually started around 1990-91 at Temple University under the auspices of Dr. Malefe Asante. And so that was, kind of the penultimate level of the understanding of the discipline of Africana Studies. Now, this is critical for us to keep on, you know, to understand, because we see the regression that we're seeing from the federal government, understanding about who we are in this place and time is actually critical. And you don't know where you're going if you don't know where you've been. And you have tons of students who are walking around saying, I'm not African, my family's from Detroit, right? And not really understanding who we are as an African people, and also understanding that the history of African people and us as African Americans, when I say African Americans, I mean, I don't care if you're from the Caribbean, I don't care if you're from Puerto Rico, I don't care, but if you're a person of African descent and you're living in the Americas, in my mind, you're African American. And if you want to use black as opposed to African American, that's cool. I prefer the African American nomenclature because it connects us to a land and a history, right? There's no, you know, black land per se. We do know, you know, where the African continent is, right? And we can get into the whole, you know, lexicon the etymology of the word Africa, and actually that it was actually named after Leo Africanus, who was a European explorer, da da da. But we accept it for now. So we can go back and call it a Kebulon, or at one point they used to refer to the whole continent as Ethiopia. I mean, I'm happy to have those conversations, and that's the conversations people want to have. At this point, though, I just accept the African American moniker, but to understand that it wasn't 1619 when the first ships came here, but really understanding ancient Kemet or ancient Egypt, understanding Nubia, understanding, you know, the Yoruba, the Songhai Empire, the traditional, the ancient some empire of Ghana, right? So the country of Ghana is about to have their Independence Day on March 6th, which happens to be my birthday. But, you know, Ghana, that country was actually named after the Empire of Ghana. Right, and so sometimes you read history, understanding those differences, but it is a connection to African people and worldwide, which I think this is critical, which is why I don't refer to black studies, I already refer to Africana studies, because I think that we always have to connect ourselves both to a landmass, a history, but also to the diaspora, and understand how we're all connected in that dynamic. And so, even though I stumbled in this conversation, I'm happy to be part of it. Let me know. Up until recently, I was a member of the Higher Education Committee, so I do a lot of work there. I actually have taught Africana studies at Brooklyn College, John Jay, University of Albany, Old Westbury, Mega Evers, Columbia, this is an important theme for us. One of the things that we're talking about now is a bill by Senator Zelma Myrie and Diana Richardson. And that's a bill to force every single school to integrate Africana studies, actually black studies or some kind of black history course, which is different, black history course into the curriculum, something we ought to be expressing and understanding. But part of the conversation needs to happen amongst you, if you're college students, to get students to actually take up minors or even if you're a dual major, take up these majors, and I'm not saying that we have to keep up the discipline of Africana studies just to keep it up. I'm saying that there's a real efficacy, a real importance as people of African descent to understand your own history, to understand where you come from, to understand the connection between you and the larger world. Such that we are not just producing people who are coming out trying to be capitalists and want to work on Wall Street, or if you're going to be a teacher, if you're going to do something. Understand the modeling that comes out of it, because how we operate as people of African descent is very different, right? And there's three kind of things, I'm going to end on this, three kind of things that we should be paying attention to. One is epistemology, how we understand truth and knowledge, right? One is cosmology, how we construct the universe, right? And one is ontology, how we understand our state of being, right? The Europeans and African people understand their state of being very differently, right? The penultimate ontological statement by Europeans is from Descartes, right? I think, therefore I am. African people think about it very differently. They say, I am because we are, and because we are, therefore I am, right? We see ourselves ontologically as ontological communitarians, right? So the unit of analysis for African people was the family. The unit of analysis for Europeans is the individual. And that gives you very different outcomes, let's say in public policy. It gives you different outcomes in the way that you teach in a school. It gives you different outcomes if you're a psychologist or a social worker and you're trying to diagnose somebody or give a treatment plan. There's no way you would ever give a treatment plan in an African context that doesn't include the family, because you understand that, right? You would never start, not include people's spirituality in the context of how you treat people, whether it's educationally or whether it's psychologically, because there's no national association of African atheists. African people, by definition, are spiritual people. And I have that argument with you all day, every day, up and down. Not saying we're religious, not saying we belong to a particular religion. I'm saying we are spiritual people. We and our epistemology, our understanding of truth and knowledge comes out of an understanding of God. We understand truth and knowledge vis-a-vis our relationship to the spirit world. Right? And so that, you know, you look at the failure of the Black Panthers. Part of the failure of the Black Panthers was their overdependence on Marxism. And one of the core tenets of Marxism is a rejection of religion. So you can't organize African people long term and reject religion. Right? Because African people are not gonna follow anybody who don't believe in God, because that's where their moral authority comes from. Right? Which is why you wind up with you know, Denmark Vesey, Gabriel Prosser, Nat Turner, all being Baptist ministers who started some of the early resistance movements here in America, right? The first thing that Marcus Garvey creates when he creates the UNIA, the Universal Negro Association, is the African Orthodox Church, right? And it's out of the African Orthodox Church that you get a brother named the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, who was in Garvey's army, who then becomes the creator of the Nation of Islam. Right, see the brother wearing a bow tie here, that's part of the connection. You understand that about Black conservatism? It is Garvey who comes here in 1913 to learn from Booker T. Washington. Garvey starts wearing bow ties because his hero and his model, his role model, is Booker T. Washington, who wore bow ties. Which then Elijah Muhammad, being in Garvey's organization, starts wearing bow ties because Garvey wore bow ties because Booker T. Washington wore bow ties, and that's why you see Malcolm X and all the brothers now who belong to the Nation of Islam wear what? Bow ties. Right? Real thing. Remember, African people, you are the people who were here the day before yesterday, and you're going to be the ones who are going to be here the day after tomorrow. So keep bringing good into the world and let no good be lost. Love you.
Come on, keep it moving, because I want to make sure we have some time to...
The school system was based on white supremacy. Let's be real, the public schools was not created for us. And therefore, it currently stands that they don't think about us when they are creating curriculum unless it is intentional. They do not think about us when creating programs unless it is intentional. They do not think about us when creating after-school resources and supports unless it is intentional. And it has never been intentional until we have stood up and demanded. So when we see racism in our schools, it is at every single level, starting at pre-K all the way through college, right? We've heard that story already. My personal story, there are many because I've got four children, but one being where I watched my oldest, they wanted to suspend her, but they didn't want to suspend somebody else. Same situation. And I know what the difference was. I have a Black child and the other child was white. And the words that they used to describe my child were not the words they used to describe others. So she was disruptive. And they were worried that she might be dangerous. This was fifth grade. Because of a story she wrote that was about General Hospital. Let's be real, it was Sonny Corinthos. It was about a soap opera that she watched with her grandmother, right? But because of that, they were concerned. We should really look at her. Let's talk about this. But when someone else writes an elaborate story, they are inventive. And look at their extensive imaginations. And when other children are talkative, they are inquisitive. But when our children talk, they talk too much, or they are disruptive. So we see racism in our public school through every single thread. And we, for 7 years me, and for longer many others, have been fighting against that in our local communities. I started off as a volunteer with Alliance for Quality Education and Citizen Action of New York, being a parent advocate and activist. And now I'm the state organizing director for Citizen Action of New York. That's investment in our leaders. And now that's what I get to do, to create that change and to allow other parents to be able to stand up and create that change in their local schools.
Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around.
Thank you, Mr. Willie Terry, for attending that event and bringing us another awesome, awesome segment.
And now we're continuing our technology series with Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Imani Taylor and high school student Imari Allen.
Hi, this is Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Imani Taylor, and I'm here with Imari Allen, a high school student in Troy. Hi, Imari, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Could you just tell me a little bit about yourself? What grade are you in? What are some of your hobbies?
Okay, so I am in 11th grade. I like to write poetry, reading. I sing, and I like to work with animals and older people.
Cool.
Yeah.
Okay, so would you say that you grew up in the computer era, whatever that means to you?
No and yes. I grew up in the country, so we didn't really use phones and stuff until I came up here. That's when I started really using a lot of phones and laptops and stuff.
Okay. And how old were you when you got your first cell phone?
I was 12, I think.
Yeah. What kind of phone was it at that time?
I think it was a BlackBerry, with the buttons and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What did you use it for mostly at that time?
Games and texting my parents.
That's it. And you have a phone now?
I do.
Looks like a smartphone.
Mm-hmm.
How would you say you use your phone differently now than you did when you first got one?
Well, now, since there's more apps and I know more people now, I text friends, I take pictures, post stuff, and just look at... I don't play games anymore.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I would think it would be the opposite now, since there are more games available.
It would seem that way, but...
Do you use a computer in school?
I do.
Do you have your own personal computer?
I do, too.
And is it, required? What kind of school do you go to, and how necessary is it to have a computer?
Well, at my school, we use computers every day, all classes, except math. I don't really use it. But we use, a smart board, so technology is still being used.
Okay. And I understand you like journalism, and you have to write a lot of essays.
Yes.
So I'm guessing you use a computer a lot for that.
Yeah. But I don't like to type, so I handwrite it, but my teacher, he prefers typing, so it works out, I guess.
Have you always used computers in school?
Well, pretty much, but as I told you, I was in the country, so in classes, we didn't really have to use it. We wrote most of our stuff until I came up here.
And when was that?
I came up here 8th grade.
So in elementary school, it wasn't really
necessary.
Okay. Do you have siblings?
I do. A bunch of them.
Do they use technology?
Yes, they do.
Are they older or younger?
Well, I'm the oldest, so they're all younger. And my brother, he's 4, and he loves to play on the phone all the time.
He has his own phone?
No, he uses my mother's.
Thank God. So how would you say technology has impacted your life in general?
Well, my life in particular, I feel I don't really socialize with people in person. Before, I would, go outside and play. But now that I have a phone, I can just stand and still talk to people and watch stuff. And I guess you're more aware of stuff that happens in the world because you do have a phone and stuff gets posted and you have firsthand, you can see it. But if you don't have it, then it's you don't really know what's going on because you're not really paying attention to it. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
That kind of leads into my next question, which is, are you on social media?
I am.
How do you feel about social media?
Well, I've deleted my Facebook 3 times. For me, I feel like social media is just a place where you can gossip and talk about people and make... It's just... I don't really like it because it hurts people's confidence sometimes.
Yeah.
So I tend to just stay away from it. But I do get up there because there's funny stuff to look at.
Yeah.
But other than that, I don't really like it.
That's fair. That's really all the questions I had for you. Is there anything else you wanted to add in relation to computers or technology?
No, it's pretty much everything was in there.
Okay. Thank you so much for talking with me.
No problem.
Mm-mm. Okay. That concludes. Oh, no, I'm sorry. And I'm your host, H. Bosch Jr. Our engineer tonight is Imani Taylor. And nope. Okay.
Our engineer tonight is Jai Kwan, and we want to thank Imani and Imari for that wonderful segment. Up next, we have Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Larry Becker, who speaks with Tyshawn Goldston of Hitters Boxing Club.
Hi, this is Larry Becker from Radio Free Albany, and we're doing an interview with Tyshawn Goldston of Hitters Boxing Club. And we're on location at Grand Street Community Arts, 68 Grand Street, Albany, New York, which is the location of the boxing club. Let me ask you this, Tyshawn, before you started your business, did you have a background in boxing?
I've been boxing all my life, off and on. I mean, I was in the gym, a young kid. My father was a professional, so I was boxing off and on. I didn't start taking it seriously till about 15, and after, you know, maybe from 15 to, I had my last fight at 33, and, you know, like I said, I was never 100% dedicated to competition, but I was always training in it all the time, always helping out in the gyms.
What inspired you to start your own boxing club?
First, I was still training, and my son started boxing, and there were certain things that were going on, like, I want to say more politically than anything, you know, and I wanted to really bring him above and beyond the regular things that were going on. I didn't just want to settle for the norm, and I kind of felt like where I was like the big fish in a small tank.
Okay. And what was it like getting the club started?
Opposition after opposition, man. Obstacle after obstacle.
Like, who was setting up the obstacle?
I mean, life in general, and mm-hmm. it was... The city has a program already, so it was kind of in, you know, when you're trying to do something and it's already a program going, it's hard to get people to support something and they already got something going. I felt that the results that we were getting spoke for themselves, but it was still hard to get funding to help get people to, you know, want to push the program.
What age groups do you work with?
Well, I take them at ages 8 to, I take them a little younger than that. I take them at 8 to compete. But I take them at 5 for personal training.
Wow.
You know, at 5 years old.
That's great. How do you think most of the boxers or the parents of the kids, how do they find out about you?
Well, a lot of them find out through social media. A lot of them know about through word of mouth. Program's growing.
If they wanted to go on social media, what would they go to? What site would they go to?
A lot of people, you can find me under Hitters Boxing Club.
And how would you spell that?
HITTAZ, Boxing Club. You could also hit me up on TyTrax under Facebook, TY space TRAX. Contact me directly about how to get your kids in the program, how to get them started.
Did you have, was your dad a mentor to inspire you to get into boxing?
Yeah, well, my father was one of the main reasons I'm into boxing. You know, like I said, my father boxed when I was young, so I seen it young. And he never pressured me to fight, but he always wanted to show me the art of it and made sure, you know, I was always sharp. So when I did it, he wanted me to be 150%, not 100%.
Shoot high, right? Shoot high, definitely. What kind of training regime do you do at Hitters?
Well, the training regimen is different for all different level fighters. Like, my novice fighters will have a different training regimen than my elite fighters. And what I mean by that is when they come in the gym, I work them on basic fundamentals for the first few weeks, where we might just work on the jab and the right hand and stepping in and stepping out for the first couple of weeks, just till they get that down and I have a foundation with them. The more elite fighters, we might work on, you know, pivots, flurrying, you know, adding tricks to the arsenal after we've learned the basics. So for each level fighter is a different training regimen. And I think as my job as a coach is understanding where they belong and what they belong doing to keep on winning the fights and winning the competitions.
Okay. So you're African-American. Mm-hmm. Do you run into any racism around your business?
Not more politics than racism. I mean, I know racism exists, but a lot of time it's when you feed into it or you play into it. But more or less for me, it's more political than anything. You know, to me, the political is the big racism to me, the politics that's involved with, you know, like I said, trying to get your business to the forefront, especially when there's another competitor that might have, you know, different avenues to promote and advertise than you have, and even the funds. So
yeah, sometimes the doors aren't opening, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, certain things I would like to do that the powers that be, I don't think they'll let happen. Like, I would like to throw a show, you know, a big boxing show down at, you know, Lincoln Park in the middle of the park or at the softball field. Those are things that I've been, you know, trying to do and I want to do, but they're not actually coming together for me, you know, so.
Not yet.
Not yet.
Not yet.
But I have other things in the making, so.
Okay. So I tried to do a little homework here on the benefits of boxing. I'm going to wait till the truck goes by there. So, like, if you wanted to sell the art of boxing to parents, what would you say the benefit was to the kids?
Well, first, I think that getting them involved in a group activity where they learn, you know, how to be a part of a program first. And I had kids that come in that I know that they're not going to be competition boxers, or some of them don't even like the fact of being in a fight. But when those kids come in, day out, and they start to learn the program, they become involved with the program to where if they feel like they missed a day, they miss something.
Yeah.
So, first of all, they become part of a team. Secondly, they get the confidence that they need to believe in yourself. I have some kids that are getting bullied, and, you know, we teach them self-defense. That's the main thing, you know,
yeah.
Self-defense, to defend yourself, never to go out there and, you know, use it if they don't have to. But, you know, to learn how to defend themselves, we teach them the proper technique. And like I said, I feel like it's the team atmosphere. A lot of these kids come here also to be around their friends. And the main reason why I do the program is to show them something different than what they're seeing, the norm in the community every day. So my program is, I call a lot of these programs dead-end programs because there's no outlet. After you do what you do every day and you reach your goal, there's no prize in the end. You know, the kids know that if you meet the requirements and you do what you have to do, there's a next level. And we might be going to, you know, Rochester this weekend, but next week it might be Las Vegas, and the week after that it might be France or wherever. So they know that it's just not a dead-end program. They know there's something at the end of the rainbow.
Yeah, that's nice. That's really good. Do you have any advice for somebody else who wants to start a business? Not necessarily a boxing club, because who needs more competition? But you know, but like other businesses.
Yeah,
because you're an entrepreneur. I mean, you've got your own business here.
I say jump.
Jump at it. Go for it, right?
I say jump and see if you can fly, you know? If you got wings, you're going to fly.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Is there anything else you'd like people to know about Hitters Boxing Club?
Yes, Hitters Boxing Club isn't just about the competition, the boxing. If you want to come work out, get in good shape, even for your kids just to be a part of a program, we have about 25 youths that come interact every day. And like I said, I've had most of them for, you know, 3 years or 3 years or more. So a lot of the kids that are with the program stick with the program. And they stick with the program because of the results. A lot of them want to be part of some. And in the last year or two, we had about 10 kids ranked in the top 5 in the USA. 10 kids from Albany. And how many kids do you know around the world that are ranked in their own city or ranked on their own block? Not many. So you get, you know, 10 kids out of the same gym ranked in the top 5 in the USA. It's something going on that I feel like the community needs to take notice of, because a lot of other places we're a lot more recognized and known than we are here, because a lot of people aren't in tune with what's going on. You know, we put it out there, but I feel like as these kids get older and they get bigger and revenue starts to be involved, then people will take notice. But sometimes we tend to forget that these small kids will soon become men.
That's for sure. So you're located at 68 Grand Street, Albany, New York, in the old St. Anthony's building, which is now owned by Grand Street Community Arts. Yep, Madison Avenue and Grand Street. And this is Larry Becker doing the Taking Care of Business segment of Radio Free Albany. And I've been talking with Tashawn Golston of the Hitters Boxing Club. Thank you.
Thank you, Larry Becker, for speaking with Tashawn Golston of Hitters Boxing Club in Albany. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady. We now talk live with Peter Lesser, the executive director of the Egg in Albany. Peter, Hi.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Welcome to the show.
Well, thanks. I'm happy to be here.
Okay.
So tell us what the Egg is.
Well, the Egg is a performing arts center. Really, its official name is the Nelson A. Rockefeller Empire State Plaza Performing Arts Center. But because of its egg shape, it took on the nickname of the Egg early on in its existence back in the late 70s, mm-hmm. and has been known as that ever since that time. And it is, as I said, it's a performing arts center. We have two theaters within. One seats 440, one seats 980. And we go year-round with a variety of performances, mostly music, some dance, family performances.
Oh, okay.
And we also have a whole level of dance studios. We have a resident dance company called the Ellen Sinopoli Dance Company. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we also have the Icoon Ballet Theater is a company from New York that comes up and does a three-week residency in the summer. So we keep pretty busy.
Such a good lineup. Okay. Such a good lineup.
Absolutely. So, what are some of the highlights coming to the Egg this season?
Well, we have, everything's a highlight, of course.
Absolutely.
And we have a variety of series. We talked about dance. We've always had modern dance at the Egg. We have the Ellen Sinopoli Dance Company is our resident company. And actually, they will be doing their annual performance on April 12th, which will be a full evening performance. Of a work that shortened is called Vine. It actually has a much longer name, which I don't have right in front of me. But it's a very interesting work. It combines, dance and visual arts as well, using some sculptures made specifically for the performance. So that's always a highlight for our year because, again, the company is in residence rehearsing in our studios throughout the year. And it's always great to finally have their performance coming up. And a little bit later, we'll be talking about a whole series of jazz performances that we have scheduled coming up.
Nice.
Very soon will be, actually we have two right in a row to end March. March 29th mm-hmm. is the Joshua Redman Quartet.
Oh,
and then on March 30th is Pat Metheny's new project. And more, much more to come.
Yeah.
So again, the, highlights, we just have a lot of varied programming and, we finish the month with the New York Theater Ballet doing Cinderella. So
amazing.
I wouldn't say there's something for everybody, but we try.
Okay.
Just a little bit to bring it back to the Sanctuary. The Egg is co-sponsoring an event here at the Sanctuary on May 4th, celebrating the 100th anniversary of the birth of Pete Seeger. Can you describe a little bit about that event?
Oh, absolutely. We have one of our often ongoing programs is called New York Living Legacy,
mm-hmm.
where we explore the legacy of an iconic New York State-based artist. And Pete Seeger, well-known as a New York artist,
mm-hmm.
Made his way in Greenwich Village, New York City as a folk musician and then moved up to Beacon, New York. But probably, I think it's safe to say, probably maybe the best-known folk singer ever. Very, very well known. And this is, he would have been 100 years old.
Bob Dylan.
Bob Dylan.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, that's right. But Bob Dylan, he was more famous as a rock musician than a folk musician.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but
well, he sold out to money.
Well, you know? I don't know. I think he went the way of his muse and he was very successful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And obviously very well known. More in the singer-songwriter vein of his own work, whereas Pete Seeger is more known for carrying on the great traditions of, various traditions, actually, of blues and folk and bluegrass, great master banjo player, certainly the king of all time of sing-alongs and getting people to sing, but more importantly, just really using his music not only to entertain and make people happy in that way, but to further various causes. Mm. And go ahead.
So real quick, before we go to the next question,
Sure. Tell
us a little bit about your history and your background. I understand you're from New York, a native New Yorker.
Yeah, I'm a native New Yorker as well. So, maybe there'll be a New York Living Legacy about me one day. You never know. I'm from the New York area, but I've been up in the Capital Region since 1992. Originally came up and was the managing director of the Troy Savings Bank Music Hall, the amazing concert hall above the bank downtown here. And then I've been at the Egg since 2000.
Okay.
So in June, Joan Osborne is going to perform some songs by Bob Dylan on June 22nd. Has she done such a show before?
How about that, Bob Dylan?
Hey, it all keeps coming around. You know, I guess we were going to talk about Bob tonight. Who knew?
The kid turned out all right after everything.
That's right. Well, he's something. She has performed at the Egg a number of times. The last time she did a couple of these tunes. She was just putting together her project, which was a full album of Bob Dylan songs. Mm-hmm. And now that has been recorded, now she's touring that. So
nice.
It will be a full evening of that. But it is not going to sound like Bob Dylan. It's going to sound like Joan Osborne singing some pretty amazing songs
with amazing.
Some really, really good arrangements of some songs that you'll probably recognize.
Great. Well, trust me, I'm sure it won't sound like Bob Dylan. Just like when Steve sings some of his favorite country artists, doesn't sound like them. It sounds like Steve. We'll leave that where it is.
All right.
So I'm sure you've seen several, but what were some of your favorite shows from recent seasons?
Well, again, you know, like I said, they're all highlights. You know, it's almost like when you say, you know, who's your favorite kid, you know? Yeah. But I think that, you know, some of the artists that have really struck a chord, I think kind of bring it up to what we'll be talking about a little bit later on jazz segment. We have some artists come back to us on a regular basis. One is Savion Glover, the amazing tap dancer.
Right.
And he's brought many,
he's real good.
Many projects to the stage at the Egg, some for the first time.
When was the last time he was?
It was about two and a half years ago, and he actually came with the great saxophonist James Carter.
Mm-hmm.
And James, I say that because James is actually coming back in April with his organ trio. To perform at the Egg. But there's something about Savion is just really what...
So talented. He's
a force of nature.
Oh, yes.
And he just digs in. And like I said, we've been presenting him up, you know, every couple of years for 20 years. And, you know, and I would like to say starting when he was in his prime, but he's one of those artists that, you know, he doesn't seem to age. He just dances till, I mean, he can keep going, it would seem.
Feet don't fail me.
And
it's
so it's like watching a new show every time.
Exactly.
It's almost like he doesn't use the same choreography ever twice.
Exactly. And most of it, admittedly, is improvisational.
Yeah.
But he just has a way of really, he's a musician as much as he is a dancer.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And a great percussionist.
And an entertainer.
And an entertainer, yeah.
He
doesn't
it so
put his back to the audience. Yeah. Exactly, yeah. So that's always a highlight for us is when Savion's in town.
Mm-hmm. So what do you do, or what do you view as the Egg's role in the music and art scene, and how well do you feel that you are filling that role?
Well, probably the unique thing about the Egg is part of our mission is to support and expand the artists of New York State. And the arts. And that's where this New York Living Legacy project comes up. We also have another initiative, which is called New Work New York, where we, inspire or we hope to inspire or be a catalyst or to support new work to be created by New York State artists.
Yeah.
And to kind of spread the word that way. So in that way, we've kind of created our own little niche. We also are the administrator of an organization called the New York State Presenters Network,
mm-hmm.
which is all of the presenting organizations in New York State and provide support for them as well.
Awesome. That's great that you're supporting New York State artists. I love that personally. So where can people find information about these projects and also the schedule for the Egg?
Yeah, and the easiest is on the web, www.theegg.org. And we have, of course, the full schedule, a place to buy tickets, and then some links where you can look back and see the types of things that we do, and then look at pictures of the Egg, because it's a one-of-a-kind place.
Right.
Thank you.
Well, before we close out, we have a few more minutes. So let me ask you something, Peter. Seem like you have such a fascinating career and the things that you're involved with at the Egg. What would you be doing if you weren't doing this?
Usually my main occupation would probably just be finding a beach somewhere and just walking it endlessly. Is probably what I like to do when I'm not doing this, although I'm thinking
Let
about
me know.
It all
I'll
the time.
I'll be glad to fill out that application,
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well, let's go together.
Yes. And I'm a fine beach walker.
Okay, yeah.
I've studied all over the world.
Yeah, I know. You know, it's something that never gets old for me, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, again, admittedly, you know, doing this is a, you know, it's a full-time job and then some, and but it is, it's rewarding, you know, when at the end of the day, when you're standing, you know, in the back of the theater and you see a full house of people enjoying something that you helped to at least create or get people out for, it's a good feeling, and it's a somewhat of an addiction that us presenters have, and we just keep doing it, and occasionally knocking our head against the wall, but you know, on those nights when it's good, there's nothing like it.
I feel like in order to fill your role, you have to be a lover of art, of the arts, and you also have to be an artist yourself. Would you consider yourself an artist?
You know, I wouldn't consider myself an artist in the way that you normally would think of it, but I think that you know, putting together presentations, they actually do call it, you know, curating a performing arts season. Mm-hmm. So in that way, I think I'm a presenting artist. I'm not creating any of my own music or dance or visual art. But in that way, I think it is somewhat of an art form.
Absolutely.
And it's also a bit of a science. I mean, there's obviously research you have to do. And it's also a lot of times a matter of luck. And, you know, if you, you know, get by and you didn't have that snowstorm, it makes all the difference.
Yeah.
Right.
How
right.
do you feel at the end of the season when you watch all of the performances that you've kind of curated and put together? How do you feel after that?
Yeah, it is. It's definitely a feeling of pride and satisfaction. Like I said, the season never really ends. But again, when you put together like a report and say, okay, you know, you look it back and that was pretty good. I'm glad that I had a part in that. So yeah, for the most part, you know, it is a feeling of satisfaction. And again, the gratification really is just knowing when people come up to you and said, I really had a great time last night. It really meant a lot to me or to my kids, or they had never seen dance before, whatever it is. And to be part of that is really what it's all about.
Yeah.
Wow.
Nice.
Well, hey, Pete, thanks so much for stopping by. This has been an education beyond my wildest imaginations. And, promise you won't be a stranger.
No, I'll come back anytime, and thanks for being interested.
Okay. All right. Well, we look forward to seeing you again real, real soon. Okay.
Thank you.
All right. That concludes our show, this time for real. And we hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm your host, H. Bosch Jr.
And I'm Jada. Our engineer tonight is Jaquan. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get your daily dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or a tender confession, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in at 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
As a reminder, Hudson Mohawk Radio Network is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in volunteering with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or just stop by one of our weekly meetings held right here Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Until next time, folks, I'm your host, H. Bosch Jr. Thank you for tuning in.